Today's episode of Invisible Capital is sponsored by Ansarada. Since 2005, Ansarada has been trusted on over 23,000 transactions, including M&A, capital raises, divestments, restructures, and IPOs. The new Ansarada Deals smashes the benchmark in deal technology. The secure deal space includes project management tools, AI-powered data rooms, collaborative Q&A, and integration frameworks. It's more than a virtual data room. It's a total transaction management solution across the full deal lifecycle. Start for free at Ansarada.com.
Hello and welcome back to PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast. I'm Adam Lewis, a reporter for PitchBook News.
And I'm Alexander Davis, editor-in-chief of PitchBook News.
Today we're talking about emerging technologies, which is always a fascinating topic. We spent season two diving into health tech, food tech, mobility, and supply chain. So be sure to check out those episodes on this feed if you haven't heard them. Today, however, we're going to take a closer look at some of the very real technologies that are shaping where we live, how we work, and the ways we might travel between the two.
Right, Adam. And actually, we're doing a special kind of split version of the show today because we'll be hearing first from my chat with Asad Hussain, the senior PitchBook emerging technology analyst who covers mobility. And it's a huge space with far-reaching impact. So it's going to be fascinating because we are going to cover air taxis, electric vehicles, and how SPACs have been affecting this market.
And then we will get into my conversation with PitchBook Quant Research Analyst Zane Carmin for a conversation about the world of real estate tech. That's maybe not quite as flashy as flying taxis, but those technologies have a much more, let's say, immediate impact, especially as we start approaching varying return to office strategies. But first, here's the conversation between Alec and Asad.
Asad, thanks for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out with one of the industries that you're paying special attention to lately, and you call it eVTOL, if I've got that right. What is eVTOL?
eVTOL stands for Electric Vertical Takeoff and Landing, and it's all part of this emerging passenger air mobility industry, which comprises both aircraft manufacturers of eVTOLs, their enablement technologies, and air taxi service providers. The whole idea behind this is replacing, you know, internal combustion engine powered vehicles such as helicopters to dramatically lower the cost of urban transportation while reducing emissions and traffic congestion within cities. The main advantage that eVTOLs have over helicopters is a much lower noise profile, which allows operators to operate a much higher frequency of flights and expand routing closer to residential areas. Practically, the result of that is you can operate many more flights during the same amount of time, and so you can ultimately be moving more people and operate a much more profitable mobility service. At the same time, eVTOLs have fewer maintenance requirements compared to helicopters since they have multiple rotors with more redundancy. And so your operational costs should be lower since you have fewer maintenance intervals. You don't have to deal with fuel costs. And then finally, and this is a more long-term benefit of the industry, but it is the issue of autonomy. Because air taxis rely on multiple rotors, they're much more controllable. And so it's much more feasible for you to actually think about removing the pilot or potentially augmenting the pilot with autopilot features to lower the bar for who can become a pilot. And that's going to radically improve the unit economics of operating an air mobility service.
It's a fascinating area, which obviously raises a ton of questions from technology to financial to, you know, environment and regulatory issues. So I wanted to just briefly touch on a couple of those to follow up. One is you mentioned that it's a lower noise profile. I'm curious, like, how noisy or how quiet are these rotors now? And then on the market side, how much of the market is seen as really just kind of replacing or augmenting the like conventional helicopter service versus, say, an even broader passenger base, people who now rely on ground transportation to get around, you know, like a metropolitan area?
So on the noise front, it's pretty significant. eVTOL aircraft developers will tell you they're targeting reducing noise level by as much as 20 decibels relative to helicopters. And even beyond that, you know, a lot of the reason why helicopters can be so annoying if you live under, you know, a helicopter going by, it has to do with their specific noise profile. Because they have a, you know, single rotor and it's spinning, produces a very low frequency noise, and it can be quite annoying. With these eVTOLs, not only is the noise level lower, but the perceived noise level is even lower than that, because you can really tailor the noise to be less annoying.
Because they're smaller blades.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Volocopter, which is a company in the space, actually did a demonstration, and they surveyed spectators on, you know, how loud or how quiet the aircraft was. And basically, the results were very positive. Spectators were mostly had the reaction of, wow, that was quieter than I expected it to be. And so, you know, that's hugely important, because, again, it will lead to higher frequency of flights and increased routing. And that kind of leads directly into your next question, which is, okay, so why does this matter? Is this really going to be something for, you know, just business executives and high net worth people who would be riding around in helicopters anyway? Or is it going to be something for a much broader audience? And I think that question right there really boils down to the fundamental question of, is this a viable industry? And is this an industry worth investing in? Because if you're just replacing helicopters, that's not a huge market, first of all. And it's not really what I think is generating a lot of the excitement that we're seeing. What is generating the excitement is the expectations that the cost advantages of eVTOLs will reduce the cost of air mobility from around $9 per mile, which is where it is today with helicopters, to something much closer to a ride hail at around $2.50 per mile. And that has huge implications in terms of the total addressable market for air taxis. You know, you're not just talking about business executives or high net worth people. You're talking about regular people using it for their commute.
Well, I understand that a lot of these companies, maybe most of them in the eVTOL space, are talking about commercializing their product, their services, by the early to mid 2020s. Is that realistic, given the kinds of hurdles that are out there, you know, technological and regulatory among them?
I think there's a lot of hurdles out there, you know, both in terms of improvements in technology that need to happen, things like battery density, but also external constraints such as charging infrastructure, landing infrastructure, air traffic control, airspace management, not to even mention the significant strides that need to happen with autonomous autopilot. So, you know, layering all those things together, I'm skeptical that the industry will hit significant scale in the mid-2020s. I think a more reasonable timeline is late 2020s to early 2030s is when we're really going to see this industry take off.
Okay. Well, building on this issue of the barriers that they have to get over, talk for a second about, I mean, in comparison to what roughly similar kind of industry has gone through, the autonomous vehicle startups, who have also faced, you know, some really big questions, have major technological hurdles, as well as regulatory things to get past.
So people, you know, when you sort of make comparisons between autonomous driving and air taxis, people in the air taxi industry sort of raise their eyebrows because the technological challenge is so different. But at the same time, I see a lot of parallels between those two industries, right? You both sectors are developing really disruptive transportation technologies that are capital intensive, will require billions of dollars in investment to develop, manufacture, and scale services. but also promised to, you know, deliver a multi-billion dollar market that could reshape the landscape of urban transportation. They have both set really aggressive timeline expectations for the deployment and commercialization of their technology, with autonomous driving really targeting 2020 and the early 2020s for deployment, and now air taxis targeting 2025. I think the air taxi industry right now is sort of at a peak of expectations. And as we get closer to that 2025 date and the challenges associated with actually developing and scaling the technology get realized, I think it's quite likely that we'll see a timeline reset on the cards as the market, the companies and investors sort of realize the actual, you know, complexities and difficulties of actually getting through this process and achieving commercialization. You know, there's so many parallels between these two industries. A lot of the same engineers in the air taxi space have come out of autonomous driving startups in Silicon Valley. You know, even the recent news of a lawsuit occurring between Wisk suing Archer is somewhat reminiscent of the Waymo suing Anthony Lewandowski over IP being taken. So, you know, the same trends are happening. Financing trends are also very similar. You're seeing many of the same active investors in both spaces across automotive and air mobility. And the recent SPAC trend has been very prominent across both industries, helping both autonomous driving and air taxi startups go public.
So you mentioned the financing side of it and the investor opportunity. Can you tell us briefly about the size of this market, you know, what you expect from it, and for perspective, to put it into perspective, what is that, say, compared to some of the other legacy segments of the transportation sector?
Yeah, so we're forecasting the global air taxi passenger mobility market to grow from approximately $1.5 billion in revenue in 2025 to over $150 billion by 2035. That's equivalent to approximately 19.4% of expected global airline revenue in 2021. Initially, we expect eVTOL rollouts to occur in, you know, high-income cities in relatively mild climates at a relatively high price point. However, as aircraft volumes sort of roll out and the technology gets better, we're gradually going to see the price of air taxi transportation to decline until it becomes closer to ride-hailing at under $5 per seat mile. And then as far as the sort of investor opportunities, I think a lot of investors are excited by this potential market. And so, you know, what we've seen is that the first quarter of 2021 was really a breakout quarter for the space in terms of investment. We saw $3.8 billion invested into eVTOL air taxi startups, more than triple the investment in all of 2020, which was mostly through VC deals. And in Q1 2021, most of that investment went into either SPACs or their accompanying pipe round of three companies, Joby Aviation, Archer, and Lilium. So, you know, I think that's very interesting. I also think it's interesting how the investor base that's investing in air mobility is quite diverse. You know, major investors include technology companies like Intel, Tencent, Qualcomm, and Google, which might see an opportunity to supply software automation and cloud computing. But we're also seeing interest from strategic transportation investors. You'd expect it from aerospace companies like Boeing and Airbus and airlines like JetBlue and United, but you're also seeing it from automakers and auto suppliers like Toyota, Stellantis, Daimler, and Continental. I think that's very interesting to see the convergence of automotive and aviation in this way, as both of these industries sort of recognize that this is the future of mobility and they don't want to be left behind. And finally, VC firms like Andreessen Horowitz, Lightspeed, Lux Capital Management have been very active in the space.
I think it's safe to say that, you know, almost everybody who's anybody in technology and in, you know, even legacy companies that are looking for a way to transition to the new economy, the next generation of technology, they see this as something they need to get a piece of, right? So, speaking of financing, and you mentioned earlier the rise of SPACs and the high degree that SPACs are getting interested in this space in particular, what is it about, well, I guess we're talking more here about mobility broadly, but it does include the air taxi companies. What is it about the mobility and electric vehicle market that has drawn so much interest from blank check companies?
What we've seen over the past year has been kind of the perfect storm for mobility startups, because we've had not only the pandemic, which was initially very challenging for mobility companies, but at the same time, you've seen really investors rally around all sorts of mobility companies, whether they're EVs, eVTOLs, you name it, as the pandemic has really highlighted the discrepancies and inequities in our transportation systems and highlighted the need for technologies and solutions to improve them and make them more sustainable and equitable going forward. And so, you know, you've seen that realized in the significant amount of investing going into mobility startups, with over $25 billion in venture capital invested in the first quarter of 2021. You've seen that with the rise of the SPAC as a financing vehicle, and you've seen that in the soaring valuations of publicly traded EV or mobility companies such as Tesla and NIO on public markets. I think it's really interesting how we've seen this huge shift in investor mindset, almost do a complete 180 from where it was 1 or 2 years ago, where, you know, there was all this skepticism out there over this transportation space and how capital intensive it is and how, you know, a lot of these startups and companies are money losing. I remember, you know, how much scrutiny Uber and Lyft faced immediately after IPO over their path to profitability. Now it seems like investors are really have this growth mentality. And they're really, as you said, focusing on the future market opportunity. And they almost see it like the next smartphone, like this is the next big thing. And whether you're a VC or a, you know, technology company or a transportation company, you really don't want to be left behind. And so, you know, in the midst of all of this, SPACs have become very popular. And, you know, they really are a match made in heaven with mobility companies, because, you know, a lot of mobility companies are characterized by money losing, cash burning, highly capital intensive business models. Some of them are even pre-revenue and SPAC. And, you know, these tend to be high risk companies, and they would likely struggle to find buyers in a traditional IPO. But SPACs have really come in to fill that void. You know, they tend to receive less scrutiny relative to traditional IPOs, and they allow these startups to share their vision more easily and provide long-term financial projections. A bit of a question mark with the SEC's latest remarks, if that's going to be allowed to continue, but at least from what we've seen so far, SPACs have been very successful at sort of bringing these types of companies to market and allowing them to communicate their vision of this large market opportunity to public equity investors and allow public equity investors to gain exposure to a space that has historically really only been in the purview of private investors.
Yeah, and for good reason. I mean, we're talking about really, really, as when it comes to risk, about as high risk as you can get in both the technology and the transportation spheres. So it's no wonder. And I have to wonder if investors are really, I mean, the public market investors are really cognizant of what they're in for. And, you know, in particular, I think about the projections that are being made by some of these, you know, pre-revenue EV startups. You know, take Lucid, for example, which is a case I wanted to specifically raise with you. Some very, you know, high stakes and big market opportunities are being sketched out by their backers. Question I have for you at the moment, though, is like, is there really enough capital for a company like that going through the SPAC market, particularly companies like Joby, in the air taxi industry? These are such capital intensive companies that really still have many, many years to go before they develop. So help us understand that risk profile and how much capital they're going to need and whether they're really getting enough and what that means going down the road for future capital raises.
It's an important question. And I think it's something that has kind of resonated through the market. Our EV mobility price change index showed a really strong performance, over 90% in the second half of 2020, as all of this, you know, exuberance was really occurring. But in the first quarter of 2021, it was actually down more than 20%. And I think a lot of that was due to this recognition of the market of exactly what you just laid out, is that a lot of these projections are really, really optimistic. And many of these companies are going to struggle to actually execute on those plans. And I agree. I think, you know, when I look at the extended timelines many of these companies are going to face, I absolutely think that they are going to need to tap into the public markets again and raise additional financing rounds to do so. You've already seen that happen with a few of these, including QuantumScape. And in my mind, the key question is, will the sort of public market enthusiasm for this EV mobility space be strong throughout that process? I think as the quarters go on, as we get through 2021, 2022, and you know these targets keep getting pushed back, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that dynamic plays out. But I agree. I think, you know, looking at the air taxi space, you know, we call out, you know, companies that have raised over $1 billion in capital as being enough to get them through the certification process with regulatory authorities such as the FAA and EASA. That's really been the focus for air taxi startups so far, is just developing the technology and getting it commercial ready. But I think they're going to require hundreds of million dollars more to actually scale out their mobility service offerings and commercialize that scale, much in the same way that Uber and Lyft had to raise billions of dollars to achieve the scale that they have now. And so I think the capital that these companies have raised may not be enough to get them through a commercial launch. And that's a key risk for investors.
Which suggests that they would have to at some point go out and do some kind of private placement type of thing, or perhaps turn to, you know, government in some cases, or, you know, sell a large stake to, you know, a private investor.
Yeah. Or just, yeah, do a public offering. And I think, you know, it's one thing when you're a private company to do that, that's kind of expected. But I think when you're a public company and you're facing a lot of scrutiny over your timeline and your growth targets, and then you're having to come out and raise additional capital, it's always the risk of investor sentiment turning against you and that having negative repercussions for your stock price.
So Asad, while we're talking about predictions, give us a prediction about the longer term for the viability of these companies in the air taxi space.
I think a lot of consolidation is on the cards for the air taxi space. When I look out at the extended timeline, the high capital needs required, and compare that with the over 100 plus startups developing air taxi technology, I think a shakeout is on the cards. And I think, you know, by the end of this decade, I would be very surprised if there are more than half a dozen air taxi startups left remaining in the market. So what you're going to see is that the tail end of the market is just going to kind of drop out as they struggle to raise money, but you're also going to see a lot of consolidation, especially as the aviation companies enter the space, especially as automakers really start ramping up. So I think that's going to be really interesting.
And who's best positioned to be the ones left standing?
Yeah, I think we call out two factors in the report. Number one being the amount of capital raised so far. So far, the companies in the lead there include Archer Aviation, Joby Aviation, Lilium, Volocopter's also raised a decent amount. But then also, number two is the amount of manufacturing partnerships and the quality of those partnerships and who those partners are. That's going to be a key differentiator. Joby has a partnership established with Toyota to help with their manufacturing. I think that's going to be absolutely huge for them. Another one is Wisk, which is founded by Larry Page and is basically a joint venture between Cora and Boeing. And so they have Boeing as a manufacturing partner. And I definitely would not count them out. That is a huge competitive advantage to have a leader in aviation behind you.
Totally. Great stuff. It's been great talking to you, Asad, on this. Thanks so much. It's been fascinating. Appreciate you coming on the podcast.
These are exciting times. Thanks for having me.
Zane, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
You're here today to talk about real estate tech,
which is obviously a pretty broad term. How do we classify real estate technology and those areas of investment?
It depends on who you talk to. You could get a lot of different definitions of what falls into that category. Some like to think of it as broad disruptors to the real estate space. You know, you think about real estate from a traditional sense, it's probably the one area of investment that we all touch every single day of our lives, whether it be in your home, in the office, in retail centers, restaurants, et cetera. And so the way that we want to try to think about it is, you know, classifying things into those broader buckets of how one uses space. And so we have three main categories, one being commercial, the other being residential, and the third being construction, which obviously impacts the first two. Under the commercial umbrella, it's pretty broad. We have a large set of subtypes that we can go through, but the main food groups would be asset utilization. So think of your WeWorks of the world, Industrious, or your supply chain management type of companies. On the property management side, as another subgroup, you have, you know, startups that are focused on helping landlords track how their properties are performing and manage their tenant interactions. And then you have real estate transaction solutions, finance and investment. And then on the residential side, you also have real estate transaction solutions. So everyone's, you know, looked at Zillow or Redfin, I'm sure. You also have on the residential side, home improvements, renovations, and then finance like mortgage tech, you know, Rocket Mortgage really popularizing that space. And then the construction side, there's, you know, a lot of different categories and new technologies there, whether it be 3D modeling, construction robots, property management. The big players in the space in terms of capital raise has been in the modular construction business. And so think of Katerra and that group.
Mm-hmm. You touched a little bit there on, you know, the commercial real estate space. And one of the big things we've seen over the last year with the pandemic is obviously the shift to remote work. How has the migration out of urban centers impacted what emerging real estate tech is being developed?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that is probably top of mind for all real estate owners and managers, investment managers, et cetera. You know, even companies themselves, you think about the troves of information technology companies that have announced several work from home plans, even post pandemic, allowing X percentage of their workforce to, you know, work in some capacity from their homes. Think of Spotify, Facebook, Twitter, and Square, et cetera. There's a long list of different companies that are exploring those options. And what does that do to the office market is one big question. But then also, what does that do to the residential markets? We've already seen, you know, record level housing price appreciation over the last several months that has driven off of that, where you have people basically, you know, I wouldn't say fleeing urban centers, but are definitely looking at their rents that they pay in their small one or two bedroom apartment in an urban center, comparing that against what their mortgage payment would be if they were to buy a three bedroom home, you know, 20, 30 minutes from downtown, where originally they wouldn't want to do that commute. But if they're being working from home or working from home 2-3 days a week, you know, those economics seem to make a lot more sense. And so seeing that dynamic play out is driving a lot of investment within, you know, mortgage technology to help manage that home buying process, you know, take advantage of this huge demand shift that we've seen on the, you know, supply side. The reason why we've seen such huge home price appreciation is just the lack of homes available for sale. So then you get into questions of whether construction technology can help speed up the process of the home building process. So there's a lot to be, you know, kind of unpack there on the commercial side, kind of go back to the office angle full circle. How does the tenant and landlord relationship, you know, play out over the next several years? Does the landlord, you know, or will they be willing to offer more flexible relationships with their tenants, and what other services and add-ons and things like that can the office landlord implement to help the tenants manage their space? So there's a lot of new technologies and developing sensors and AI and machine learning to track movement and usage of space, productivity, health conditions and air quality, things like that. So It's really a breadth of different areas that are impacted.
Yeah, it's crazy how the COVID-19 pandemic has created, you know, just winners and losers, you know, investment-wise in even, you know, one asset class here. You know, you've got the drop in demand for commercial real estate and, you know, the rise, obviously, with rise in demand for, you know, residential real estate. You would think that, you know, maybe that would balance out over, hopefully, you know, as we get back to a normal, is there a thought that that could balance out here over the next, you know, 1 to 3 years?
Yeah, I don't think there's a question. Things have to start to balance out. You know, you could make the argument that we're kind of simultaneously in an asset bubble when you look at the residential side, and also in a financial crisis when you look at the retail side. And even the office has been less impacted just because of the longer term lease nature of those relationships. And so office landlords can, you know, as long as the long term tenants continue to remain in those leases, then they should be okay. But yeah, on the retail center side, they've been decimated. They were struggling before the crisis as the shift to e-commerce has accelerated. And that has really impacted, on the other side of the coin, the industrial real estate space. Think of your warehouses, distribution centers, which has led to a lot of investment within supply chain technologies.
Right, right. I cover obviously the private equity industry for the newsletter and website, and Blackstone, biggest player in private equity, has been gobbling up warehouse, like millions of square feet of warehouses for the past, you know, 5 years. And they've really accelerated it during the pandemic, as kind of a, I guess, just a play on, is it e-commerce? They want to buy up all the shipping, all the places, you know, that you store your Air Jordans before they ship out. Or
yeah,
is that kind of their thought there? I'm not 100% sure, but
yeah,
they're a pretty savvy investor, so I figured they know what they're doing.
Blackstone's a great point. Like on the traditional real estate side, warehouses, distribution centers were never, you know, the quote unquote sexy asset class. They never have been. They're just four walls and a roof, and you have some trucks going in and out, who cares? But then starting mainly after the financial crisis, Blackstone and others really noticed that there's a real chance that the shift to e-commerce would hyper accelerate as the internet connectivity, the connection to our phones. You know, we have all of these access points to stores in ways that we've never had before. And e-commerce would sit at the very center of that, and therefore industrial warehouses would sit at the very center of that. So they identified the trend early on, and you're right, they've only, you know, doubled down on that bet, and so far it's paid off handsomely for them.
Yeah, is there any hope for the, you know, kind of the retail space as we, you know, hopefully vaccines roll out and we get back closer to normal? I mean, obviously a lot of these retail companies have, you know, already have pretty heavy debt loads, and then the pandemic happened, and you know, you've got heavy rents on top of that. It seems like it obviously was a you know, killer combination for a lot of companies.
It was, definitely. And you saw, you know, companies like Brooks Brothers, Neiman Marcus, JCPenney all hit bankruptcy proceedings, and it'll be interesting to see how the shift out of COVID plays out. I think that we'll continue to see more and more foot traffic gravitate more to retail centers. People want to be out and about, and a lot of big retail landlords, think of your mall owners, like your Simon Property Group being a big one. You know, we're investing a lot in the experiential side of their properties. So you think of a big mall that has a movie theater, it has some breweries or a bar, you know, different things to do for the kids, things like that, that brings families together, rather than just your giant Macy's warehouse, essentially, where people try to go find, you know, 30% off deals. That's not really the value proposition for retail centers anymore. And COVID's really emphasized that point.
Yeah, I feel like we're just going to see more private equity firms kind of pour money in to try to, that, you know, turnaround play. It's just like the classic, you know, hopefully buy low and, you know, develop something and then sell high in, you know, 5 to 7 years.
And it raises an interesting point, kind of getting back into like the real estate technology front. There are startups focused on the space where, and within retail centers, you know, that you can install trackers and sensors to kind of measure the amount of foot traffic that your retail center is experiencing, see where the problem areas are coming up, how people are utilizing your space.
Wow.
And so that offers a lot of capability in terms of new data sets that retail managers and retailers haven't had before.
Does that raise any privacy concerns if you're just being tracked every time, you know, you walk in to buy a pair of shoes? Or that's just the first thing that I think of.
Yeah, it depends. I guess you could see a world where you probably need to have some sort of disclosure to say, hey, just so you know, we are, you know, tracking foot traffic. But I think that for a lot of people, it probably will go unnoticed to them. There are other startups, too, that access cell phone GPS data to measure the amount of movement at a very local level. So you can measure how many people are going to a mall, for example. There may be some privacy concerns around that for sure, just because you're accessing people's location data. It's anonymized, of course, but you know, as we've all seen with cybersecurity issues across industries, you never know, you know, how secure that data could possibly be.
Yeah, and as a consumer, it just seems like we're so used to giving over all of our information now, either willingly or unwillingly, that
yeah.
I guess it may be. Wouldn't be you, as big of a can, problem as
yeah. You can some make the think. Argument. You can make the argument that, you know, installing some sensors around your retail center, your strip mall, or your big outdoor space is very similar to just latching cookies on to you as you kind of browse the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Or
which we've all accepted.
Tracking, you know, on my iPhone, tracking my steps, you know, over the course of the day. It's not, I guess, that much different, given that, you know, GPS wise, it knows exactly where I'm going. So what are some of the new challenges to adopting, you know, these new technologies in real estate? I know that it's pretty expensive. So, you know, to replace legacy systems. So things, you know, it has to be difficult to get things off the ground.
Yeah. So it's really dependent on the organization, really dependent on the technology that we're talking about, the end user. You know, real estate technology and real estate, as we've kind of touched on, is just such a broad space that there's within each of those different subcategories, there's going to be a lot of supply and demand, you know, divergences. I think on the commercial side, some of the more interesting startups that are seeing success will be like in the property management, tenant engagement, data analytics side, where you have, you know, some more sophisticated institutional quality investment managers working for real estate investment firms that are looking for new tools to help them manage properties better, or to find their next property, or to help them fill in, you know, occupancy for, you know, opportunistically invested assets. And so there's some incumbents in the space that are publicly traded on that front. AppFolio comes to mind as one that's pretty interesting on the property management, lease management space. Then there's CoStar and CoreLogic, which interestingly enough had announced a merger, or at least they were in talks in a merger, but they recently called that off. But those two are on the data analytics front and helping, you know, on the commercial transaction side, find properties and data points on various assets within their data sets. But, you know, for the most part, you probably call those lower tech type of solutions. You know, they're basically just software wrappers. There's some, you know, learning in the background that's probably done to aggregate some of those data sets, but nothing, you know, front and center and really scary for a real estate manager to have to deal with. If you get into the more sophisticated, you know, kind of going back to the sensors and trackers that you can install, not just in retail centers, but in, say, you own an office building in downtown San Francisco. Do you install a bunch of sensors, you know, thousands of sensors around your building to track how much foot traffic's in the lobby versus, you know, in different conference rooms, elevator usage, all of that kind of stuff, you know, has the capabilities of offering a lot of data, but it's hard to, you know, really imagine how much you can really unlock unless, you know, you start to play with it more and more. So those have been slower to really take off. But coming out of the pandemic, I think there could be, you know, a real boon to those types of technology companies, because we're on the health space, you know, tracking how air quality is or how many people are in a room if we mm-hmm. continue social distancing, things like that, you know, will be only possible through those types of technologies.
Yeah. Can't be cheap to set up all of those sensors in every room, I would think.
No, absolutely not.
That's a big investment from a company standpoint. I mean, I know we want to be healthy, but.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting. There are some companies that are offer good examples of how you can go about doing that. So there's VergeSense, which has raised $21 million in 2020, and they've announced a partnership with real estate firm JLL to install sensors in several buildings across the country. It's kind of a tester program. So far through the first quarter of 2021, VergeSense has about 40 million square feet of space that they're currently tracking. So if they find some success and can unlock some data analytics for JLL and their other clients that they're working with, I think that you'll see that type of technology take off across the space. You know, everyone's looking for their next edge.
Certainly their timing could not be better. I wonder if they started during the pandemic or it was an idea before that maybe they were one of those companies that, you know, really not lucked into, but were you know, fortunate to have developed this very specific technology that would come in handy during a pandemic.
Yeah, it is a very specific technology. They only started, I'm just looking at the PitchBook platform right here, and we have their first accelerator round in 2017. So they're a very new player in the space. And
that's impressive.
First Series A and Series B was in 2020, and we're able to raise a couple of rounds there. So definitely seeing some acceleration in terms of investment there.
Zane, are there uses for blockchain technology in the real estate space? Is this really a thing that's going to happen that I'm going to be reading about?
Is there a Dogecoin equivalent?
Is there a Doge equivalent to real estate tech?
So blockchain is something that I've had some conversations with. I've talked with a few different startups that are in this space, and the most interesting application of blockchain that I've seen is the tokenization of individual assets. There are other startups that are looking at putting whole assets or, you know, property databases onto the blockchain. So think of, you know, your property database that, you know, is basically housed at your local county, you know, office, and putting that data onto the blockchain rather than just having it sit in those folders or, you know, Excel 2003 files, right? So trying to increase the sophistication and do it in a smart way. There's some startups that are focused on that. But like I said, I think that the most interesting area of blockchain within real estate would be the tokenization of assets. We've seen some properties that have been tokenized to try to see how that proof of concept would play out. And so there's one startup called Meridio, which is a part of the Consensus umbrella, and they tokenized an asset in Brooklyn a few years back. To my knowledge, they haven't done a whole lot since. I was just actually looking at their website yesterday, you know, in prep for this conversation, and they haven't really updated anything in terms of new press releases or blog posts in like a year plus. And so it seems to me that experiment hasn't really played out as swiftly as they think that they had originally thought. So it'll be interesting to monitor for sure, especially as now blockchain is and crypto in general has really seen this third, call it, wave of interest, and we might start to see things pick up again.
Zane, is part of the, I guess, push to tokenize, you know, the real estate tech world, is that to simplify things in some degree? Because, you know, somebody who's bought a condo or, you know, dealt in real estate, you have to sign so many documents. I mean, it is the most convoluted, sometimes frustrating process that you could imagine going through as a human being who's trying to buy something.
I'm with you. Can the home buying process be simplified? My fiance and I, at the very start of COVID, actually purchased our first home as a condo, and it took, you know, weeks. Miles and miles of paperwork, and I mean miles of paperwork.
Right.
And this was the beginning of COVID too, where everyone was very, very, very self-conscious about, you know, social distancing. There obviously weren't vaccines around, but you know, the only way that we could go through the signing of those documents was we had a guy from the mortgage company come to our apartment that we were living in. We were in our lobby and just signing documents for about 45 minutes.
I had the same experience. Yep.
Is there a better way to do that? I would think yes, but it's tricky, and the real estate space, to think of it in terms of, you know, the breadth of human history, real estate's the oldest asset class there is. And so inherently there's just a baked in, you know, skepticism for new developments, new technologies. And we can get into a lot of that within the construction space as well. But sticking with the, you know, the blockchain tokenization question, it is an effort to simplify the process and also to make it more accessible to access, you know, apartment buildings or office buildings to individual investors, or at least smaller investors. And so part of the value proposition for those types of startups is, you know, normally you would need to be able to write, you know, a multi-million-dollar check in order to invest in a high-rise apartment complex within, you know, your urban center that you're living in or you want to invest in. Instead, if we can tokenize that asset and break it up into pieces, then you can buy essentially shares of that asset on the blockchain.
Democratizing and finance.
There you go.
That what was could exactly, go wrong?
Took the words right out of my mouth.
What yes. could go wrong?
Yes. So democratizing the real estate buying experience from the commercial side. You could theoretically make the same argument for homes, but who wants to tokenize their house? As I've heard that argument that you could blockchain the entire residential library of supply available, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't want to have some random investor in Singapore or something owning part of my home or something like that. So it'll be interesting. I think the commercial usage is probably the place where it makes the most amount of sense. But then, you know, you can also make the argument that we already have the tokenization of commercial real estate assets. They're just publicly traded REITs. You know, you talk about Simon Property Group, you have Equity Residential on the apartment side, you have Prologis on the industrial side.
Credit default swaps, right? That's
yeah. We won't get into that.
That's getting too far afield, but in a way, they're trading mortgages basically.
Well, they own individual properties, and they are essentially a portfolio of office assets or apartment assets. And then if you buy shares in those, you essentially own shares within those assets. You get your dividend payment from the rents that they collect. So like I said, in a lot of ways, we've already tokenized those assets. We already kind of unlocked that piece of puzzle through public markets. But, you know, we like to talk about private markets, and a lot of people like to focus on private markets. And so, you know, taking that concept, but then making it apply to the private market, private real estate market would be, you know, I guess their goal.
Which part of the real estate tech space are you most excited to watch kind of develop over these next few years?
So yeah, there's a lot that we can unpack. We've touched on a lot of different areas. I think one area of interest that I have is on the construction side, seeing if some of these construction startups that are focused on modular technologies, robotics, AI machine learning applied to the home building, you know, property development process, if those can really find some legs to start to run. This may be a great opportunity for them, as we've talked about the home price appreciation because of the insatiable demand that people have had for new homes. And it's become a real supply issue, especially in places like California and the like. And so it'll be interesting to see if these companies that are, you know, marketing themselves as reducing costs and the time to put up, you know, four walls and a roof, if they can find success in kind of supplying those pockets of demand that right now have not been satiated. So that's one area. I think that the most interesting, though, just it being one of the largest asset classes, would be the office space. You know, how does the commercial relationship between a tenant and landlord kind of play itself out as we come out of the pandemic? You have all these companies that are experimenting with work from home. We've all done some experimentation with work from home, and it's worked really well. I think a lot of companies have found that their workforce is very productive in that capacity. And so how does that change the demand dynamics for, you know, your Class A office building in New York or San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago? You know, if you can have a workforce that can be more, you know, disparate and located in, you know, secondary or tertiary markets, think of your Salt Lake City, your Austin, San Antonio, Las Vegas, you know, Miami. You can kind of go down the list of these markets that are a lot cheaper on the real estate front for a tenant to come in. If I'm, you know, call it an Apple, and I want to open up a new HQ or a new regional center, I'm going to go to a cheaper market, and my talent will just kind of flow there because they can work from anywhere. Or, you know, take that out of the equation entirely, I don't even need office. and everyone can just work from their homes because we've done it so well already. And a lot of people want that flexibility. And so to see how that dynamic plays itself out, it will be probably the most interesting because it'll have the longest term impacts, just given the nature of those lease structures within the office commercial space.
Yeah, well, we will definitely have to have you back on the show here, you know, as that story unfolds, as the narrative plays out, and you know, we get back to something resembling normal. But real estate tech is not the only thing, obviously, you write and research about. What do you have coming down the pipeline next that we can get excited about?
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's been a great conversation. Real estate technology is, you know, super fun to talk about. We have other things that we like to focus on the quantitative research front. So we have some quantitative perspectives, reports that are becoming across in a couple of months, and those will be free to download for the general public. So I can definitely encourage to check those out. What we try to do there is, you know, bring more data analysis and tell a visual story of what's happening in private markets. And so I believe the next one that we'll be putting out on that front will be in the venture capital space. So highly relevant to this conversation, but with cross industries, not obviously just real estate technology. We also have one that we put out for the private equity space, which we actually published a few weeks ago by a colleague, Andrew Akers, which is a really interesting read. And then we're also working on a report focused on the private equity industry's performance, you know, versus a basket of, you know, your 60-40 equity bond split, and kind of seeing how private equity, venture capital, real estate, as a fund performance kind of plays its role in a portfolio for an institutional investor. So interesting, not as exciting or as flashy as talking technologies, but definitely highly topical.
Yeah, something tells me the private equity firms will find a way to make a profit. I'm just going to throw that out there. So we'll have to have you back on to talk about it. Yes, they do. With that, I just want to thank you for coming on the show today, Zane. This was all great stuff.
Yeah, really appreciate coming on and talking real estate technology with you. It's always good to get into the weeds a little bit.
That's right. That's what we do here. We're all about getting into the weeds. All right, until next time.
That does it for today's show. Thanks for listening to Invisible Capital. And if you'd like to get more information about the podcast and the relevant reports that we cited, you can visit us at pitchbook.com/podcast. Please also rate and review the podcast wherever you listen. I'm Alexander Davis.
And I'm Adam Lewis. Until next time.
Invisible Capital is a production of PitchBook. Executive produced by Kai Yao. Hosted by Alexander Davis and Adam Lewis. Cover art by Landon Early. Subscribe to Invisible Capital on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, visit pitchbook.com/podcast.
We talked about the tenant and landlord relationship, how those... Cat, sorry, this cat is being crazy fine. Right now. I'm gonna have to restart, I think.
Mine is passed out right next to me. I think, you know, animal noises in the background adds some color to the show occasionally, so don't worry about it at all.
As a hard disagree, but
Kai's very appreciative of it.